feet four. He fights with missiles and with spears. He's on 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for a thousand years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist, and a Baptist, and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting in Canada, he's fighting in France, he's fighting in the USA. This way, and he's fighting for democracy or fighting for the red. He says it for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Dachau? Without him, in a war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from him, and you and me. And brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put an end.
Welcome to the New American Dream radio show. One of our pet rats, Ginger, died this morning. Last night she was fine. In the middle of the night, the other one, Anne, woke us up with her crying. Ginger seemed listless. My wife, Lorraine, told me she thought Ginger was dying. Well, we held her. We comforted her. Anne laid on top of her. This morning, he kicked a couple times and breathed her last. It's amazing how fast someone can be gone from your life. Person or animal, the change can be abrupt and painful. We'll miss Ginger. We'll miss the way that she held her head at an odd angle and stared at us. We'll miss the way she looked out for her friend, Dan. Now, last week, we let the two of them out for a little while and in the apartment, and Anne decided she didn't want to get back in the cage. We couldn't catch her. We put Ginger back in the cage, left Anne out, and in the morning, Ginger managed to get out of the cage, go find Anne, and they were both sitting there waiting for us to take them back home, back to the cage. It was really amazing. There's news of somewhat more national import. You know, Green Party candidate Jill Stein was arrested last night for attempting to participate in the debate. Not a joke, no. This is real. It's a real indication of how far America has fallen. We have so-called debates, but we restrict them to the two big corporate-controlled parties. There was a time when third parties actually were given a chance. Of course, back then, our votes actually were counted. Cops wanted to help people instead of locking them up. I don't know. Maybe none of that was actually real. Maybe that was, well, just a dream we dreamed one afternoon long ago. A few years ago, I was denied the right to read something aloud at a funeral. I didn't end up going to jail like Jill Stein, but I did get escorted out of the funeral home just because the family was too busy cutting down their dead son. my best friend. They couldn't give me time to say something nice about him. I guess they were afraid I might say something about them. His own son got up and talked about him being like Bart Simpson. This is at a funeral. That's when I stood up. I'd brought my notes with me. They'd already told me that they wanted me to read them privately at the family ceremony. But when I heard that, when I heard Robbie get up and say that, I stood up and I wanted to go up front. But I didn't even get past the end of the aisle that I was in. I was escorted out by the sheriff. So I'm going to read it to you now. "10 years ago, I had just been promoted to be the manager of Pure Print. It was part of the Pure Center, a place where people who've had mental health problems, consumers for short, can go to provide support for each other. At Pure Print, these consumers could learn or relearn skills that might allow them to work. The training program was supposed to be getting more formal than it had been in the past, and there was a new position called a job coach. I was a bit nervous. This job coach would be working with me full-time, although I had no say in selecting or hiring him. Would we get along? Would he take it into his head to coach me as well as my employees? Would he try to take over the place? Well, the administration folks brought in the new job coach and introduced us. He was a very large man, but somehow not intimidating, not at all. He seemed just as nervous about the whole situation as I was, and he seemed to need the job just as much as I did, too. And he was funny. Well, for the next couple of years, Tony and I ran the print shop as equals most of the time. We both worked on the creative aspects and day-to-day operations, and I did have final authority, although I rarely exercised it. We grew to be best friends, and over the years, he came to consider me as a brother, even though he already had a lot of them. He was a family of 11. I was an only child. Tony was the only brother that I've ever had. No more than 2 weeks after Tony came to work at Pure Print, one of the other workers came to me one day and told me I should check on him. She was worried. She didn't think he looked good. When I talked to him, he told me he was fine, just a little tired, but I could tell it was more than that. I asked him if he was in pain, and he told me he had this sort of crushing feeling in his chest. Well, that was enough for me. I immediately called 911 and notified administration that I'd done that. And of course, it turned out I was supposed to have called them, and they were supposed to be the ones to call 911, but since they'd never trained me on any management procedures, they weren't too terribly upset. Paramedics came, took him to the hospital. There had been angina, not a heart attack. Everyone, with the possible exception of Tony, thought I did just the right thing. That was my introduction to Tony's health problems. I thought he was going to die right then. When he didn't, I suppose I got to think he never would. That's why I was so shocked to get a call from the sheriff the other night. I just couldn't believe it. Still can't. Tony and I had a very similar outlook on life. We both believed in taking people as they were, at face value. We both tried our hardest to be non-judgmental. We both did our best to help people. I think it's safe to say that we helped each other in the few years we had, more than most flesh and blood brothers are able to do in a lifetime. Neither Tony nor I had a great deal of respect for authority. Both of us preferred to avoid confrontations, yet both of us would attack a problem head-on if there were no other choice, and each of us would jump at the chance to help the other. Tony used to sometimes enter our room, and he'd see people unhappy or angry. He'd shout, "Who died?" I feel terrible having to reply today, "You did." Makes me very angry at the same time. I wasn't done having Tony around. I don't know how many times the past few days I picked up the phone to call him or started sending him an email with a link to a web page. Doesn't seem fair him leaving like this, but not as if we have a choice about these things, is it? Tony had been terribly hurt by the death of others over the years. On 9/11/2001, his childhood friend Steve died in the World Trade Center. He became obsessed with the tragedy, reading and listening and watching everything he could to find about it. He was convinced, as am I, that the corrupt oil men who've taken over our country were responsible for the tragedy. They may or may not have engineered it, but there's no doubt they let it happen, if nothing else. Let it happen knowing full well ahead of time the details. This country were really involved in a war on terror, which started at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C. But Tony's brushes with death started much earlier. Every June, he'd become extremely depressed over the death of his daughter, Lisa. He felt responsible. If he just stayed home from work that day, he might have saved her. Well, in a similar fashion, I feel like if he hadn't moved away to a new apartment a couple months before he died, I might have saved him. But I really know these what-if scenarios are useless. That isn't what happened. We have to deal with things the way they are. Tony knew that, but he had a great deal of trouble accepting it. He wanted to blame someone for everything, and most of all, he blamed himself for everything. When his father died, he was overcome with grief and became quite irrational, striking out at the world and those he loved. When they reacted, he hit back harder. Many of his family were the victims of attacks, mostly financial ones. Sometimes he hated them. Whenever I was able to get him to look deep inside himself, he'd realize he loved them instead. Then he'd hate himself for having been petty. It was much harder to get him to look inside and find love for himself. He felt so responsible for everyone and everything that he felt guilty all the time. It's hard to realize that about him because he acted jolly all the time, but it was there. It was definitely there. I was reading a novel by C.J. Cherry called Angel with a Sword. The heroine at one point defines to herself her approach to things: love life and cuss death and be as good as you can. Well, I think that's pretty good advice. Remarkably similar to what I used to tell Tony whenever he'd feel down. He was a good man. He was a very good man. He had some pretty big flaws, but that's only fitting because everything about him was big. Not least the big hole he left in my life when he left. Tony was always there for me if I needed him, and I was there when he needed me. Except for that last time. Didn't know. Wouldn't have done anything anyway. I'll miss him forever. I loved him. I'm Chuck Gregory. I wrote that on 11th August 2007 to commemorate the passing of Antonio Guerra Burgos. And I still miss him to this day. Normally at this point I play Bill Hicks, but I talked too long tonight. So at this point, I'm turning the show over to my friend and co-host, Mike Palachek, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight, we welcome special guests Michael Annis in Denver and Albert Russo in Paris, France. And so tonight, we are gathering together for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Denver, Duluth, Paris, and wherever you are. Websites that I'd like to note: Nuclear Resistor, go there. Veterans Today, Occupy.com, the Catholic Worker website, Assassination Science, Black Op Radio, Kevin Barrett on American Freedom Radio, and the Real Deal radio program of Professor Jim Fetzer. And just to say something that probably doesn't really need saying, but the so-called New York City terror plot and the shooting of the Canadian border agent near Seattle, well, it's like when Steven Spielberg was really the hot director with Jaws and Close Encounters, E.T., Indiana Jones, all that. How many times do we have to see this play, this movie, to know who the producer is? And just remember, when you watch the CBS Nightly News and whatever CIA agent host they have on the main desk that night, Jim Lehrer, Diane Sawyer, Tom Brokaw, Brian Williams, just insert CIA every time they say Al-Qaeda or terrorist plot. Otherwise, just like when you read Time and Newsweek because you really want to be up on the news, what you're really doing is actually making yourself dumber instead of smarter. What they want is for us to think when we go through airport security or a big checkpoint on the freeway to think, oh yeah, there is a good reason for this. Hello, officer. Thank you, officer. Instead of go to hell, officer, get your hands off me. Just as in the anthrax letters they addressed to us all back in 2001, which asked, are you afraid? We can do this. We can fight back against Clinton and Obama and Bush and Romney and their handlers, but we can't be afraid. We can be afraid. That's something we really cannot control. The whole power matrix is so large and surreal. But what we can do is to not let that stop us, that being afraid. I guess that's the meaning of courage, going forward, even though you are afraid. Okay, then I wanted to continue the series I've been doing the last 3 weeks. In fact, and I'll wrap it up tonight. I was a reporter on weekly newspapers and was the editor of a small daily, Iowa Daily. I did that work until 97. I finally decided that what I wanted to say could not be said within the parameters of newspaper work. I've been writing novels, working at it since 94, but then I started working a little harder at it. In 2000, I ran for Congress, the 5th Iowa District, the western border district. I won the primary, and I was a candidate in the general election. I got 65,500 votes in that general election against the incumbent. That's 29%. I later wrote Joe Coffey's Revolution, trying to tell something of what it was like to run. I was also going to talk about some other things that aren't really connected to that, but I want to wrap it up, so I want to get through these. I was going to talk about seeing a cruise missile or some sort of guided missile while I was taking a walk on a dirt road out near my wife's parents' home in southeastern South Dakota. It was in the 80s. The thing just came in my direction about treetop level. And when it got to me, it went straight up. It did a curlicue and then continued on the same path out of sight. It was some sort of military-controlled missile and guided control. And I've wondered ever since then whether it was something like whatever might have hit the Pentagon, and maybe they were working on it. I don't know. And this is another unconnected note here. My one UFO sighting was also back in the 80s. I was driving late at night back to Norfolk from Omaha, and I saw what I thought at that moment were air balloons. Or maybe the gas station or the town had some sort of promotion, and the balloons were still hovering above the town. I came around the corner into about the spot where I'd seen the balloons, and now I saw an orange light. It was maybe 50 yards into the field at about treetop level, just ahead of me on the left side, and that lasted for about 5 minutes, and it just took off, not up, but straight ahead over the field ahead of me, and it was gone. And I often wondered what it was I saw, the balloons, and just assumed they were somehow connected to the orange light, the orange ball. And this is about my Bigfoot sighting. Starting to sound like something you might not want to believe, but once I did see, I think I saw a Bigfoot. It was close up in Spearfish Canyon. Spearfish Canyon is in the Black Hills of South Dakota. And to make a long story short, I was walking by myself, saw something that I thought was another person walking, and I waved. It did not wave. There are parts of the event that I don't remember, but I think I was about 10 feet away. I remember a deep growl, red eyes, fangs, and I was thinking, I don't know, the thought came into my mind, devil. I thought I'd seen the devil. I ran down the hill, and I forgot about it for years and years. Only recently have I tried hypnosis to recall details of the event. I tried a couple years ago in Sioux Falls, and I've got another appointment to try and remember in December with a hypnotist in Minneapolis. Okay, as I said, I'm going to wrap this up tonight, so I'll just mention briefly a few long walks I took for peace. I think it was twice that I walked from Northrop to Omaha to Offutt Air Force Base, and then crossed the line and got arrested. It was during Holy Week. One time I walked, when Clinton was bombing Yugoslavia, I walked from Sheldon, Iowa to the National Guard base in Fort Dodge. It also took about a week. And when I was running for Congress, I took a crossed-out tax form with an explanation letter and hand-delivered it to the IRS in Sioux City. Lots of blisters. Walking a long ways is not as easy as it might sound, just like jail, but there are fun parts. Like what I remember is sitting under a bridge on those walks and taking a break, just getting out from away from the traffic and eating a Snickers bar and smoking a cigarette. And it really is awesome. I really remember that fondly. Well, one more thing I wanted to talk about. When we lived in Sheldon, Iowa, I used to go over to the Iowa Great Lakes, Okoboji Spirit Lake. It's about an hour drive away. And I'd look for Bigfoot. And one time I heard some stuff like I did a knock. It was like you know that one kind of a cliche knock you do on a door, doot 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 doot, and then it was answered just perfectly. And I took off running that way, but of course I didn't see anything. But on my way home from Spirit Lake one day, I picked up a hitchhiker, and he talked about growing up in an orphanage and being taken away by the government. He talked about Vietnam, being trained to kill, and about some trigger jingle, like a TV commercial. And what I think he was talking about was the MK Ultra program, and I think it has something to do with all the so-called terrorists and mass murders we have had in this country, at least since the 1970s. I think part of the purpose of the program is to frighten the people into accepting a police state. Okay, that's it. My autobiographical sketch is complete. And now back to you, Chuck.
Mike, we already have Michael Annis waiting for us here, and I think we ought to jump right into your interview.
Sounds good. Let me introduce Michael. Michael Annis is poet and publisher of Howling Dog Press in Denver. We've been talking about Cost of Freedom, and that was a project I was part of along with Michael and Whitney Tretien. Whitney was then a student. She might still be a student. I was kind of along for the ride. It was really Whitney who did the major putting together of the contributors and their pieces, and Michael who made it a real book. And you should really see this book. It's a coffee table size, full cover, color. It's like those monks who were bookmakers and really cared about the craft of bookmaking as if it mattered. And that's what Michael Annis does at Howling Dog Press. The big publishers want something that they will be able to plop in the book aisle at Walmart and sell. And they are not real editors and publishers, in my opinion. They're fake. When writers who have sat alone in the semi-dark for years working on this manuscript that they love, they assume they are sending to editors and publishers who care as much as they do, but that's not true. And that's what's so wrong about books today. Michael Annis is a real editor and a real publisher. He'll go through your manuscript with you word for word. He'll care about what you want to say about the social context, about the cover art, and the commas. Michael, how about you take it away and tell us tonight whatever you want to tell us.
Hey, Mike. How you doing, old friend?
Good, good, good.
Hey. You know what? You're so modest, you kind of diminished your role in Cost of Freedom because I really want to set the record straight right now, because if it hadn't been for you, it was your idea, and you're the one that came to me with that idea. And yes, Whitney, of course, was absolutely stunningly invaluable with the whole thing. But if it hadn't been for you and your prescience that seemed to realize, years ago that we needed something like this, that book would have never existed. So, and that's why I so readily took it on, because I realized the value of it. And I want you to know something. When I saw Amy Goodman in Fort Collins when she gave a talk up there, and I talked with her for a little while, and I gave her a copy just as thanks. I gave her and Juan Gonzalez both a copy of cost freedom. And when she saw it, when she started going through it, her jaw dropped and her eyes just bugged out, because it was, to her, such a beautiful, beautiful production. And to realize that there were that many people, you know, common people like you and me, and over a hundred other contributors from across the United States and Canada, who had the wherewithal to put together a document, a record of things that they had been doing, you know, regarding protests against not just war, but protests against the political, essentially the political takeover of this country and the world, you know, which is equates to corporatism. So for your listeners, Mike, without you, that book wouldn't have existed. And I am very proud to have been the person to have said yes and put it together and published it. I mean, to me, it's a landmark. And it was to many of the people who gave us blurbs, including Noam Chomsky and Tom Hartman and former Attorney General Ramsey Clark and Pete Seeger, and the list goes on and on. Ralph Nader, Harry Belafonte, people, amazing people who actually grasped what we were attempting to do. So, you know, for the record, you're the guy.
Well, thanks a lot. You know, I took that book tour to the, it was to the West for Cost of Freedom, and that book, you know, especially the people really liked it, and they, you know, the work you did on it to put it together, and especially some of the people who I was able to meet who had been part of it, they were really proud. So I don't know if I passed that along before, but they really enjoyed being a part of that. What do you got?
The statement that's being made here between us is that, you know, people who aren't in positions of power really can combine forces in one way or another and bring something, birth something in the world that is of great and lasting value. I mean, that book is, of course, in my mind, my eyes, I reviewed it again this afternoon, you know, is fairly timeless. The only thing that, as I was going through it, that I saw is that what seemed revolutionary to some back then, that was, 2007, I believe, is when we brought it out, and it still seems revolutionary to many people right now. It seems somewhat naive to me right now because of the magnitude of the web of deceit that has engulfed us politically and economically. And yet at the same time, it reads prophetic and prescient, and, you know, as if it were warning us that this, right now, the situation and state that we're in is the only way it could have actually unfolded, because the machinery has been put in motion and was put in, you know, motion decades ago. So it is a great landmark, and it'll be revealing and eye-opening to many people who haven't seen it. But all it is essentially a springboard to say, you know, it's your responsibility to do more now and see more now and put together more now than was seen and understood at the time that this book was published, because we have to continue moving on, you know, as these layers of deceit are continually being revealed and peeled back. You know, it's essential that we just keep at it.
Would you, what did you want to read something from the book tonight, Mike, or how did you want to do that?
Well, yeah, you know, I marked, I bet you, 24 places, and there are some things in here. If I'm going to play a little game right now with you, if you don't mind, and of course you know who this is, but just with your listeners, I'm going to read a quote from the book, just to see how many people recognize where this, you know, who made this statement. I see in the near future a crisis approaching that unnerves me and causes me to tremble for the safety of my country. As a result of the war, corporations have been enthroned, and an era of corruption in high places will follow. And the money power of the country will endeavor to prolong its reign by working upon the prejudices of the people until all wealth is aggregated in a few hands and the republic is destroyed. I feel at this moment more anxiety for the safety of my country than ever before, even in the midst of war, end quote. So the person who made that statement was Abraham Lincoln. And he had the number, you know, back then of what corporations will do. And actually, that he made that statement shortly, a couple of weeks before he was assassinated. But, you know, this is an ongoing thing. And the reason that corporations aren't human beings is because they really have no soul. They really have no heart. You know, they have think tanks, but the think tanks don't understand this idea of morality or brotherhood among men and women or the rights of women or, you know, on and on, anything that really defines us as human. So to conflate the idea and confuse it that somehow corporations belong in control of this country because of the power that they exert will prove to be disastrous in the long run and is already proving to be disastrous as far as I'm concerned.
Yes, I agree.
Would you like me to read something else from the book?
Yeah. Just take it away, Mike. Do whatever you want to do, you go ahead.
Okay, well, you and Whitney selected and actually, solicited a lot of the contributions. I told you at the time that I would essentially solicit poems from people, poets, believe it or not. Some people don't understand the role of poetry I have. I've been publishing poetry and alternative writing since 1981, and my the value of it has not diminished. In fact, all it has done is increased for those people who really are taking a stand in their poetry. But the idea of poetry and the beauty of poetry is, for me, I'm looking for a particular poem here that I had marked. But the idea of poetry for me is one that goes beyond just this kind of self-introspection, navel-gazing is what I call it, and looks to the outside and says, okay, what is it about this context that I exist in as a human being that is so important to either support, reinforce, or to change? And when I was looking for the poets who would contribute to this, that's one of the things that I look for. I have a fairly long poem here that I'd like to read, but it is such an incredible poem, and it never fails to just point out the anguish of this nation and what is going on here, and how the soul has been ripped out of it by essentially the corporate political monstrosity that we're looking at now. So this is by a fellow named Rex Butters from California. It's called American Nero. American Nero, he strums guitar in San Diego, monkey mugs for the once prestigious Washington Press Corps, laughing with a country star, his month-long vacation nearly ending. Dragging their children, those children alive, citizen survivors in garbage, Mississippi towns, soggy kindling, fire stations flooded, buildings burned for lack of water, sweltering citizens parched, face down. A young girl, half under grimy water, floats, her pink hair clipped still in her hair, no ripples submerged. American Nero strums guitar in San Diego, draws cheers and applause from an adoring audience at a naval base in Southern California. dark, rank, smelling house, sticky Mississippi mud porch, slick living room floor, crumpled woman still holds snake fight stick, black and white dress, bodies rotting quickly in the heat, rats feasting on your loved ones dead in the street. American Nero strumming guitar during the Gulf Coast floods this time, not wearing phony ranch hand duds. If you're someone who's having to struggle between food and medicine, those days are over with, he says to seniors in Southern California. Children rest in ration boxes, hospital patients stretchered on airport baggage claim floor, nurses weep weaving dead patient faces the color of the black mud and brown water. 4 months old, 6 months old, they died right here in America, waiting for food. They're tattered dead in lawn chairs, bodies in refrigerated trucks used to ship bananas. Sick, poor, black, old, and left behind, stroke victims in laundry baskets, treated like an occupied enemy. Race, age, and bank book determined survivors as official excuses and transparent lies swarm like a thick cloud of blood-sucking flies. American Nero in sunny San Diego strums his guitar, eats cake in Arizona with John McCain, while sewage-soaked survivors cling to life in rising water atop a car. Rescue efforts pulled back to focus on looting, save the stuff, kill anyone moving it. We can't show the world we no longer value property. The self-righteous wind wing bellows shoot on sight. But the looting began long before the storm. Public funds shore up defense contractors' bank accounts, levees left in tatters. Nero-minded numbskull, king of vacations, he flew over high above. He looked out a window, a prepared statement of concern, then returned to the golf course, their devastation and misery, a flyby photo op prop. Bond, Biloxi, Maxi, Star, Thomasville, Gulfport, New Orleans, Mali, Somalia, and Sudan, survivors, their names washed away, as they will call you, will be refugees. Will they receive the $200,000-$300,000 given to each family relocating off Gaza paid by U.S. taxes? Will the U.S. government's $75 million dollar bribe offer refused by Iraqi Sunnis be chipped into the Gulf Fund? 2 days after Katrina hit, the federal rescue leader hadn't heard about 15,000 desperate, dehydrated, hungry, angry, dying in the New Orleans Convention Center from Mobile. American Nero smiled. Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me, that I may feed them to my greedy death god, American Nero sang and twanged, laughing. Mississippi John Hurt, rain your sweet fingerpick, tears on the people. Charlie Patton, roar their frustration and pain. Memphis Minnie, sing about when the levee breaks. It's 1927 again. That was just one of the outstanding pieces that were that was sent to me, you know, as contributions to Cost of Freedom. And of course, it speaks to the division between political leaders who only represent wealthy corporations and the people who are left to perish, come what may, to die in the streets, to not have their voices heard, to find themselves abandoned by leaders who betrayed them from the very beginning. So the book is just filled with. And the beauty of the book is that 100 contributors who all have a story to tell, a poem to write, a song to sing, artwork to show the world, all different and yet all unified under this this common idea of what does it mean, really? What does the cost of freedom really mean, and what are you willing to pay for it? So... Yeah, it's to me, it's still a great book. And like I said, it was so prophetic and prescient of where we are right now. How could we be anywhere else than right here? So that's what I have to say about Cost of Freedom for now. And I've got a couple other things, but I know we're kind of running short on time. I get the idea that we think we had, like, what, 15 minutes or so? Probably taken more than that already.
Well, that's okay. But, we do need to cut short for now. But could you tell folks where they get the Cost of Freedom, and also tell everybody what we have planned for next? We have one more of these planned for next month. Is that right?
Yeah, I'll just continue to read some excerpts from this, and I would like to tell people also next time what I'm doing as an editor, writer, and a publisher, because like I say, it doesn't end with one book, one anthology. We have to keep moving forward. We have to keep understanding. We have to keep evaluating and reinterpreting. And we have to keep the willpower strong toward action and not acquiescence. And I think that is most important, that this book, no matter how great, like all books, no matter how, and all ideas, no matter how profound, they are only a stepping stone toward, hopefully, a more peaceful, more unified humanity.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. And people can go to the Howling Dog Press website to pick up a copy of Cost of Freedom. And we'll see. Michael Annis will be our guest again in November, and we look forward to that. And thank you very much, Michael. And it's good talking to you again. And you have a good night.
Okay. You too, Mike. Thanks a lot for having me on.
You betcha. Right. See you later.
All right. Bye-bye.
And now it's time for another episode of The Adventures of Buzz the Space Dog. We've heard all about the Russian space monkeys who went into outer space and didn't come back until the Soviet Union was gone. And then when they did come back, they were expecting maybe a parade or a nice DACA out on Taiga View Lane, but that didn't happen. Well, the Americans had their own space dog program going, trying to match the Russians, with similar results. When those dogs returned from having been sent up by President John F. Kennedy and splashing down after November 22, 1963, the world they returned to was barely recognizable with Lyndon Johnson in the White House. Some of those dogs took the option of shooting right back out to space. Some moved to Ukiah. Some lived on the streets for years and years. Some raced to dig up some money buried in the backyard and moved to Edina. One of those was Buzz. When we last left Buzz, he had just received a certified letter hand-delivered by an unnamed new mail person packing Pomeranian spray.
Buzz pinned the envelope to the floor with his paws and ripped it open. It was from one of his old space pals, Neil, the space poodle. A real lapdog's lapdog, Neil was. Uh-oh. He sniffed the letter closely. The letter was supposed to have been delivered days ago. Neil would be here today. Oh, crap, thought Buzz. He pooped on the carpet and then sniffed it. Neil was a big shot. He'd actually been to the moon. Buzz was only a test dog, just Earth orbit stuff. He didn't have the technology then. Computers were big as whole rooms then. The radiation belt getting by a machine. All that came much later. Buzz hurried around, dusting, straightening, making the house look presentable. Pulled out all his slick moon photos and his moon rocks and set them on the kitchen table, along with an excellent Eau de Toilette 1969, Apollo Once. Won't say. Buzz sat in a chair with his nose looking out the front window. A long black limousine pulled up, right up Buzz's front walk. The driver opened the door and out walked Neil, the stately poodle, still with so much style and class and pizzazz. When the bell rang, Buzz was right there. He willed himself to wait 1002, in, nose open the door. I just took Neil's hat, collar, whistle, and muzzle, gave him the tour, and then they hopped right up on the kitchen table to settle in. Buzz poured the toilet water into the bowls and pushed over the kibble with his nose. They talked about cats and birds and people, balls for a while, and sticks. Good Buzz. Been meaning to ask you. He put one foot up on the table to drag the photos over closer. These moon pictures. He could sense that Neil was already getting tense. His ears were pointy, his fur bristly. You know, they almost looked like they were done in a studio, at least to me, that lunar landy thingy, no dust underneath it. Wouldn't there be both nosed the moon rock over where I could both see it up close? How do we know this is a real moon rock and not just something up? Well, you know, I've seen lots of these right out there in the backyard. How do we, you know? Neil growled, showed his fangs, stood and curled his tail between his legs. Buzz pushed the rock closer, got the other photo in his teeth that Neil was supposed to have taken off the other dog with a perfect reflection in the face shield. That seemed kind of improbable. Tossed it down in front of Neil. Neil nipped him. Neil bit Buzz right on the paw. And he hopped down with his nose in the air, trotted over to stand in front of the front door. Driver opened it. Neil pranced down to the limo, stood by the back door until his driver came and opened it. Buzz stood in the open doorway, watched them leave. Buzz saw himself, just a reflection, in the darkened windows of the limousine as they pulled away. Stay tuned next week for another adventure of Buzz the Space Dog. We'll see Buzz ask himself yet again, what was that? Thinking he might have heard something and then admonishing himself. Nobody else heard it. I must be going crazy. But maybe it's Alzheimer's. I wonder if I put that dog ears conversion chart that came in the Alpo bag. Our second guest tonight is bilingual international writer Albert Rousseau. Got more awards than I can think of to tell you about, and we're very lucky to have him on the show. I recently read his book, The Black Ancestor, and that's what we'll be discussing. Welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show, Albert.
Hello, Chuck. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. We hear you loud and clear.
Okay.
Well, I forgot to ask you if it should be Albert or Albert.
Oh, as you wish, Chuck, as you wish. It depends where we live.
Well, I know that you're in Paris right now, so I thought
that's
perhaps
right.
It was Albert.
It's 2:20 in the morning here.
Oh, my goodness.
No, it's okay. I
appreciate your staying up
on our show. I'm a late sleeper, so it's no sacrifice.
Oh, that's
so
good.
I've been listening to some of your interviews, and it sounds very interesting, and I'll be a fan of yours.
Well, good. We'd like to hear that. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, you started writing and how you've happened to have so many things published?
Well, the thing is, I'm not a young chicken, you know. I've been writing for 40 years. I was born in Congo, Central Africa. It was the Belgian Congo. And I've lived 17 years between the Congo, Rwanda, Burundi, and Zimbabwe, where my mother grew up. So those were the 17 first years of my life. And after that, I went to New York. I went to NYU, and graduated there 4 years later. Then I came back. No, I did not come back. I came to Italy, lived there 8 years, went back to America, to New York, lived there 4 years, translating and teaching languages for adults, mainly people from the UN in New York. And here I am now in Paris, where I've lived most of my latter life. So I started writing in New York in English, since my mother is English. You see, my mother is English. My father was Italian. So you in America, you know what it's all about, those mixed cultures.
Yes, indeed. So do you have Italian, French, and English as
That's right. Like... Those are my three languages. I always say I have two mother tongues, English, my mother is English, French, my adopted tongue, since, you know, I grew up and went to school both in French and in English, and my paternal tongue, Italian. My father was Italian there. But I write mostly in English and in French. Now, if you gave me seven lives, maybe I would continue to write in Italian too. But I don't have seven lives. I'm not a cat.
Well.
Although okay. I love cats.
So, since you grew up in the Belgian Congo, much of the story from the black ancestor must have come from personal experiences.
Exactly. I would say this is a historical, very autobiographical novel, let's say 80% of it, although Leo Dean, I'm not Leo Dean, but I went to the schools Leo Dean used to go to. You know that most schools in the Belgian Congo were Catholic schools. So I went to Catholic schools for 9 years, 3 years with the sisters and 6 years with the Salesian fathers. And so you see the atmosphere that Leo Dean is surrounded by was my atmosphere. I was that age when I lived in Elizabethville in Lubumbashi, Katanga, southern Congo.
Mm-hmm.
So I was the age of Leo Dean.
I see. And, well, our listeners not being familiar with it, can you... Tell us a bit about
the story,
the segregation.
That's right. So Leodine is a little Flemish girl.
Mm-hmm.
Her father was an American GI because during the war, Second World War, her mother had to flee Belgium to northern France. And then there was the Normandy, the Americans came to Normandy to liberate France, and her father was a GI who met the mother in Normandy. So they fell in love, and the father went, Gregory, he went back to the States and knew that the whole family would go back to the Congo because Leo Dean's grandparents lived in the Congo at that time, and he would put all his affairs in order and join them in the Congo. But in the meantime, his plane crashed so that Leo Dean never met her father. And so she grew up in the Congo. She was a very happy little white girl until the moment where her young uncle Jeff told her a terrible secret, terrible for her. He told her that her GI father had a great-grandmother who was a slave. So an American black slave, of course, there's the double connection, America and Africa, and there she is in Africa, where the slave originally came from.
Yeah,
so from that moment on, she her world falls down. I mean, she is completely her life has changed completely, even though she does not dare tell anybody, not even her parents, what she has learned, you see, and that will determine her future. She will, as you have read, she will have met a young black Congolese, fall in love with him, but then her parents knew about it, and they sent her to her American grandmother in Duluth, in America. And later on, she will work as a humanitarian in Africa. So it determined her future, and because of that, she never wanted to marry, but she adopted a young African boy.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Would you?
It's fascinating for me as an American to see that this extremely tense situation and this this structured separation between the races was not exclusive to America, but it was happening all over the world.
Of course, of course. Now, if you allow me, I might read an excerpt of the book if you have some time. Hello.
Well, I would if you have something that will be like 5 minutes or so, then we can. I would love to hear that.
To give you the gist, you know, of how she felt the moment her uncle disclosed to her that she had mixed blood.
Yeah.
A score of questions that would never have crossed my mind before were now popping up like so many weeds. The words tainted blood and unclean pursued me night and day. I felt them literally creep under my skin, though I knew I was considered a well-groomed and even fastidious child. For the first time in my life, I felt dirty inside, and no bath, no mouthwash, no perfume, be it the most delicate or the most expensive, could shake that impression. I would look at myself in the mirror more insistently than in the past, scrutinizing every single feature of mine as if through a magnifying glass. My hair was still of that light auburn shade with gleams of gold, and it still had the same silky quality that so pleased my grandmother, who liked to twirl her fingers around my locks. My eyes still retained their lovely blue-green hue that seemed to evoke the sky or the shoals of an unspoiled lagoon. As if I were being tricked by some ghostly entity, I would then focus my attention on the beauty spots that sprinkled my face to make sure these would not betray me. Till now, I had considered them an advantage. Didn't they enhance one's image, like that beautifully delicate English actress Deborah Kerr? Yet here I was, trying to hide those freckles with powder or even blush, which I borrowed from my mother's dressing table, without her knowing it, of course. Then I now felt as if I were constrained behind the bars of an inner cage, which could by some sleight of hand become visible to all. And this probability, even if it only arose in flashes, kept haunting me. Should I begrudge Uncle Jeff for having slipped open the closet door to show me the truth, or my mother, who would have kept it shut until after I completed secondary school and left the Congo? And what of my grandparents, whose attitude towards me hadn't changed? Deep down, was it pity they felt for me, permeated perhaps by a sense of revulsion? That's her first reaction, you see.
Yes, it's such a strong reaction, and clearly influenced by what she's learned what she's been immersed in up to that time.
That's right. And of course, she will become a very, very unhappy child from there on, you see. She feels she's in a prison inside herself.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I would love to keep talking about this, but
but you have
we're
other guests.
Short on time. What I would like, please tell us your latest work. Where people can find you, that sort of thing, so that our listeners.
As you know, The Black Ancestor was published by a very nice a little American press called Imago Press in Tucson, Arizona. Imago Press, I-M-A-G-O. And she also published another novel of mine. That takes place also in Central Africa, called And There Was David Kanza. And There Was David Kanza, K-A-N-Z-A. And that's also the story of a young boy of mixed blood in the Belgian Congo. So, you know, it gives you the taste of what racism was like in colonial Africa. The Belgian colonial Africa.
I wish we would have time to talk about the colonial aspect as well as the racial ones, but we don't.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you so much for joining us, and maybe we'll get you back in a month or two to, and we can talk about some of the other aspects.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate your being on the show.
For your patience, and hello to all my friends in America. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Thank you, and have a good night.
You too.
And now it's time for Let's Ask Mr. Science. Dear Mr. Science, when you were sitting in your big chair in your Mr. Science TV show office, do you ever just lean back and wonder about stuff? Like, do the different M&Ms really taste different, or is that just our minds making that up? Like, why we have never been back to the moon? Why we don't have electric cars, wind-powered, solar-powered houses, more of them everywhere? Why John Kerry and Al Gore gave up so quickly when it was obvious Bush stole the elections of 2000 and 2004?
Why candidates like Dennis Kucinich and Ron Paul get immediately lampooned and canceled by the major media. Why NPR used to be good and now it's not. Why the major media all say the same thing. But you know, certain things will never be said in public. They might even be wrong, but we never get to figure it out because certain things never are even talked about. Timothy McVeigh, why did he have this calm about him, went to his death so easily? Why are there so many lone nut terrorists? It's almost like there's a real MK Ultra and they kind of like manufacture all these things in order to scare us. You ever wonder about that, Mr. Science? Fukushima, where'd all that radiation go? Why did the sky seem bluer as a child? Why do your son and daughter have to sign up for the military and learn to kill, even if you don't or they don't want to? Why you have no choice whatsoever to pay for weapons in the military, even if you don't want to? Why certain things happen, like wars, and nobody asks you? You call your congressman and there's no doubt left in your mind, but you're a nobody. Your opinion is not sought out or wanted or even warranted. Chemtrails, global warming. Huh? Mr. Science?
And Mr. Science, do you ever sit in your car at the red light on the way home from your national television big TV show and wonder, why, Mr. Science, why, about Flight 93, let's roll, all that jazz?
And how there are bumper stickers in movies that say, let's roll, tell about how Todd Beamer and all of them saved the day and then died in a big movie plane crash. And yet there were no body parts, plane parts. We did not dig 24/7 with all available machinery to try to rescue anyone who might still be alive. Because maybe, Mr. Science, television personality man, maybe there was no crash there. Maybe, Mr. Science, if indeed that is your real name after all. If Todd Beamer and the others, crew and passengers, died that day, it wasn't in a plane crash. Perhaps, probably, killed by their own government, by the CIA, as part of a horrible plan carried out by the U.S. government and Israeli Mossad, as real evidence suggests. On September 11, 2001, the day and events that still dominate our world to this day. And yet it never happened, did it, Mr. Big Shot Science Guy? At least not like that. Maybe Beamer and the others were heroes. Maybe they fought the CIA bravely before they died. Maybe. But the CIA agents in the editor's office and TV news offices will never let us know. That movie will never be made. Won't be on Ask Mr. Science at 4 o'clock every weekday during the school year, will it? Mr. Science? Hello? Mr. Science? Hello? Mr. Science?
Well, it's been a long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. Joe Coffey, some of the media have taken to calling him Coffee Joe, making fun of him, is on the campaign trail running for Congress as a Democrat and talking out against war and border fences and prison construction. He and Gene have heard rumblings about the Democratic leadership actually wanting to sabotage his campaign, or maybe even him. The Tinkers, Sam, Ray, Karen, and Herbert, were meeting at noon, well, as they did every day, in the kitchen of Ray and Karen's place down the road from Herb's house and Sam's down past that a ways. Smith Farms Go Home. A stack of signs sat out of the porch, matching the ones in the front lawn and out on the highway. Herb and his two boys, Ray and Sam, were fighting the flurry of hog confinements that Smith Farms was throwing up in the county. Each day, Karen listened to laments and strategies about vertical integration, LDP, and land reform. Now, lately, the word revolution had sneaked into the conversations. She hoped it wouldn't come up today. The harvest was done. They had money for planting again in the spring, and she had her job some evenings and weekends in the hospital kitchen. The kids were happy, and really, wasn't that the most that they had ever really wanted?
What we need is a revolution in this country. Herb looked right at Karen and put up his cup for more coffee. She stared at him, her hands on Ray's shoulders. He counted to three silently, then accepted the cup and turned to fill it. You're damn right! Ray caught the ball and began to run down the sideline. Co-ops, they ain't for the common guy no more, said Ray. Herb nodded, the drummer for this band, keeping rhythm. Karen closed her eyes, breathed deep. Karen, you okay? Gas? Herb patted his shirt pockets for Rolaids. And to Congress, our elected representatives, Vandermeer, he says he's a farmer, but his family's rich, Ray said. Herb nodded and smiled at Karen as she shook her head to say, oh, she was fine. Herb accepted the coffee in two hands. Like McHogg and McBean, we're just the franchise managers in our little beanie caps and yellow ties. Ray went on to the second verse. Tara had seen this play before, knew each line before it was presented. He sat to Ray's on the table. He crossed her legs and touched Ray's leg with her bare foot. They tell us to plant fence row to fence row again. Prices go down, and it's a great deal for ConAgra, General Mills, Cargill. Karen looked to her. All of Vandermeer's contributors, he said. He looked over at Ray. Right. He pointed a free finger at Herb and looked over to Karen. Real pros. She marveled at how these actors had such enthusiasm for each new performance in front of the same audience. They repeated their lines each day as if for the first time. And pretty soon, said Ray. He turned to grab the little cream container from the refrigerator door, poured a dab in his coffee, and swished it around with a finger permanently stained with dirt and blood, yet perfectly clean. Pretty soon, there ain't no small farmers anymore. Really, none left the way it is. Pretty soon, everybody on the farm's working for someone else out in New York or California or Minneapolis. Ray squeezed his eyes and leaned forward, first toward his dad, then slowly toward Karen. She watched him intently. They seemed to not realize what they were doing, saying the same things over and over, but she did. This was her favorite part. And then, just like in El Salvador, where you had those 20 families, Ray said, pretty soon you got a revolution for land reform. Liberation theology. Herb thumped his thick Pony Express type bag where he carried around all his news clippings, newsletters, brochures. We could get a fair price for our product. Karen took her cue, half a beat late. Right. Ray and Herb nodded. We don't want subsidies, the men said. Handouts, said Ray. Bailout, said Herb. The vignette was to end when Herbert drummed the thick fingers of both hands on the table, as if he were a toddler pretending to play the piano. At the signal, Karen rose to get herself more coffee.
Sam coming over, she asked with her back to the men. They looked up from their papers into each other's eyes. I don't know, said Ray. Herb looked back down, reading, sorting, still arranging the papers he had pulled from the leather bag on the sacred altar in front of him. Sam Tinker was 5 years older than Raymond. He lived with his three children on another farmstead on their father's section. He also kept pigs, and the three worked together to plant and harvest the soybeans and corn, along with renting another quarter close by in a half section on the other side of Mount Liberty. Sam had been the one to go to college along with one of the sisters. He had an undergraduate degree from Iowa State in agricultural economics and a master's in genetics. He played violin, harmonica, and banjo and was teaching his girls and himself piano. For almost 4 years since Mrs. Tinker had died in her own bed in the home where she had raised her children, surrounded by those children and grandchildren and Herbert, the three had been meeting every possible noon at Ray's kitchen. Ray had told Karen, not that she didn't already know, that his mother had been the catalyst and the glue to the family. She had all the ideas. She poured out all the love, remembered all the birthdays, and attended all the Christmas concerts. She was a lovely fat lady, the kind whom you knew would be beauty queen material if she were 40 pounds lighter. She knew it, but she did not give a good goddamn about it. You looked at her more closely to see her chubby beauty because you did not quite understand it. Than if she were trim and pert and easily defined. When she was gone, not only Herbert, but the rest of the children and the grandchildren could not conceive what to do next. Here was one person, said Ray one night while sitting on his own kitchen floor in his white stocking feet, holding a quart of Bud Light in his lap as the kids read in the living room and Karen washed dishes. Here was the one person in the whole world that the world actually cannot do without. I give up. So they had started to meet there in the kitchen, the three farmers in the family, to contemplate ad nauseum their own demise, Karen presumed. So Karen was certain Sam would show.
They were good farmers. She loved them. She loved that the two families and Herb were a unit, and they had a common goal, to pass the farms and the land and the love of farming to their children. They were also afraid. That brought them even closer. That made the kitchen feel so toasty as they all sat around in their white stocking feet, sipping coffee or wine, or sitting in the living room with children and plastic containers of popcorn on their laps. Karen defined herself as the point guard of this team, making sure everyone got to touch the ball. She had to keep Herb happy, busy, yet block him from pushing his sons too hard. She knew Herbert was also playing the game, having this time in the kitchen, hearing his grandchildren, while pushing Sam to anger, to action, and Ray toward more practical matters, preserving this family farm. While Karen sat in the kitchen holding her coffee cup at just below eye level, she determined to had to forgive her. She had to do what needed to be done, be the mother and wife for these three men. You could see fear in Herb's eyes when he wasn't looking down at his papers. You could see it in Ray's entire body at any time. And you could see it in the wild, backwoods look of Sam as he raced against time, sending high winds and clouds and rain wherever he went, a human cold front. He went to the co-op board meetings and told them they were not for the little guy. He asked them what was the original purpose of the co-op, and when they didn't even know the right answer, he'd storm out. Kara knew that this strong man was afraid, just as she was afraid, of being alone in the world, nobody to talk to, no work of interest, no hope in the world. Karen and other farm wives lived in fear of finding their husbands dead of their own hands in the machine shed, in the kitchen, in the grove. They never spoke about it. At basketball games, they talked about guarding the baseline rather than hiding the 12-gauge. Every woman thinking she was the only one. That's why Karen never discouraged the noon meetings. It's a way to count heads. She accepted it as her job to be the lighthouse shining out across the white, horrifically boring stubblefield tundra, showing these three men the way home to hot coffee, pie, rest, in the kitchen. Though Sam and Herb were the masterminds and the muscle of this Troika and Baumgart brand overhauls, it was Ray who'd gotten in the paper on the radio, been interviewed by the Sioux City television stations out and back. Ray had come from one of their noon meetings and driven slowly into town to the public library, locked himself in the small typewriter room, and composed a letter to the editor. He didn't mail it. He drove it right over to the Wednesday Miracle office to hand it personally to the editor. When the letter was published the next week, the radio station called, had Ray come in to take questions on the call-in line. Then he recorded phone interviews with two Sioux City radio stations. On the Friday after the letter was published, KRTV Channel 8 and KESZ Channel 14 were backed up in the yard waiting to get to Mount Liberty Farmer on camera, the third-generation young farmer who was talking about the need for land reform, for revolution, not just a new farm bill, but a grouping together of real farmers like blackbirds on the wire before bad weather for their own protection.
Out the screen door and around the curve toward the road, they heard a deep, mournful voice singing like an Italian opera based in a Nebraska winter. It sounded as if Sam were serenading the frozen fields with his arm on the window. The music stopped. A door opened and closed. The snow squeaked, and a patter of nimble clomps barely touched the wooden steps. Sam pounded his heels into the floor, then pried each boot off with the other toe. He removed his coat, red flannel, ear flap cap, and hunter's gloves with half fingers. To Karen, through the screen, he looked like a Russian peasant folk hero. and they were all the Petroths, tangled in a zillion yards of twine. Sam ducked Tanner. Dad, Karen, his voice was deep. Deeper, Karen thought, than yesterday or the day before. Sam Tinker walked right behind Ray to the coffee pot. One if by land, he mumbled. Ray's face turned red. Herbert looked up, ready to complete the rhyme, then looked back down. Sam took his stained white mug from the cabinet, filled it, then moved to his seat at Ray's left, Herb's right. Karen looked in the refrigerator for lunch meat. Well, said Sam. The word sounded like it had come from the underground tornado shelter, his black and gray hair curled around his head like snakes, a Greek god of the Nebraska tundra. We need feed, Sam looked at Herb. County's having a tough time plowing again. Buster must have gone on vacation. I'll need to haul the welder over again. You called Pioneer? He looked at Ray. Not yet, said Ray. He rested his right hand atop the Ray's Revolution on the notepad. He doodled on a barn with a gambrel roof, grove, fence line. Sam leaned over to look, and Ray put his whole arm over the sketch. And we're going to need Indian costumes, said Sam.
Karen stood up and let the refrigerator door close on its own. For the Mount Liberty feed party, said Sam, looking seriously at Ray, who was hunched down as low over his paper as he could get. Sam sipped his coffee. They're famous, Ray, said it without sarcasm. Samuel Tinker raised his fists to his ears and crashed both fists down, stopping just short, his hands and face inches from the tabletop. What are we going to do? He growled at the stamped strawberry jam packet lifted from Hardee's. Herbert and Ray both looked at him, annoyed, a little frightened. You're 100% correct, Ray Revere, said Sam. We're going to end up putting on those little paper hats like the McDonald's managers instead of these. Stuck his thumbs into his blue work shirt. Ray and Herb looked at him, nodding in unison. Just franchise operators, Sam explained. Unless something happens, right now. He pounded each fist into the table, toppling the glass pepper shaker. It's all over. No more farmers. There'll be farming. Stuck a finger into the air. Land will get farmed, there'll be crops, but there won't be any real farmers around. Right? Sam looked to his father for affirmation. Herbert parted his stuff to make room for his arms.
That's right, he said. So what do we do? Asked Ray. He started to put a line of dashes on his sheet. Sam pointed to the newspaper at his left elbow, detritus from Herbert's leather pouch. He looked from Herb to Ray. They waited for him to continue. What's to say the next headline might say land reform revolution in Nebraska? It happens in El Salvador. 20 families owning most of the shit, and finally the little guys get together and say, let's take another look at this, shall we? Happens in Mexico, South America, all over the world. Why would we be any different? Nobody's hurting bad enough to fight, said Herbert. That's right, said Ray. I think you're wrong, said Sam. Everybody knows that six guys running six companies, sitting in six fancy rooms in six big buildings in six big cities, run most everything. I go to about a dozen coffee shops around this county, some into the next. Everybody's hurting. Everybody but Smith Farms. What we need is a pro-democracy movement in this country. Somebody to stand in front of the tanks and say, that's far enough, bud. Then Sam sat straight in his chair, resting his folded hands sanely on the kitchen table. People kind of expecting you to do something, Ray, after being on TV. You go stand in front of one of Smith's manure spreaders and see how many TV cameras show up, Karen said, then ducked below the table, pretending to tie her shoe. They might, said Sam. They just might. Karen looked up and over her shoulder with a worried face. Sam poked Ray's pad with a finger. Tell me what you think of this. Violence to achieve human rights. He looked at both of them and stared at the back of Karen's head. What do you think of that? Karen turned around to face them. American Revolution, Sam began. Vietnam, Gulf War, Kosovo bombing, abortion bombers, John Brown. Sam turned to his father to gauge how far he had gone, then looked down at the middle of the table and continued to talk. It happens. We can't keep going like this. My family, your family, every family in the county won't be here in 10 years, 5 years, if the rich folks have their way. And let me tell you, as if you don't already know, they could give a shit. They don't care about your kids or my kids or if any of them lives or if any of them dies. Never have cared about poor folks, never will. Karen sat up, her jaw roiled. We are the campesinos of El Salvador, and they are us. When you scratch the surface and get to the bone, it's all the same, said Sam in a calm, serious bass voice. The only thing we don't know is if we will fight. Vaclav Havel, said Herbert in a solemn tone. The reason I can be free, Ray chimed in, grateful that he knew the answer to this one, is I say to hell with it. And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the soldiers are thugs. All the Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security special agents sitting in the trees with guns are about average.
And that wraps up this episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. We thank you for joining us. We hope you'll be back again next week, same time, same place. We thank our sponsors, WorldNewsTrust.com, TheSpiritualUN.org, and June2508.com. And I thank you, Mike, and have a good night.
Good night, Chuck. Stay warm, and good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.
Oh.